Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Shackman. I remember when the Challenger blew up. It wasn't more than 8 hours before I heard the first joke about it. Right then, at that moment, I understood viscerally what I had long known from the works of comedians I had grown up with, like Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce, that it's humor, more than anything else, that gives us the context and the strength to understand the incomprehensible that is all around us. After 9/11, I think it was David Letterman who wondered if we'd ever laugh again. Today, it's SNL and some of the late-night comics that put into perspective the absurdity coming out of Washington each and every day. We're going to talk about comedy, the importance of laughter and humor today with my guest, Al Jeaney. He's a Chicago public radio personality. He's a professor and author of numerous books. And it is my pleasure to welcome Al Jeaney to the program to talk about the importance of being funny, why we need more jokes in our lives. Al, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Who, What, Why.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and I found your intro fascinating, and I agree with your entire thesis. And frankly, I applaud it, and I want to suggest that I tell jokes in self-defense against reality, and I think that's what you were suggesting as well.
It is humor that really does often give us context to better understand, not only to understand, but to cope with horrible things that are going on.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, you brought up two issues. It is about timing, but I think in point of fact, you're right. Humor itself disarms a situation, defangs a situation, helps to domesticate a situation, takes the absurd, the illogical, the unavoidable, the unanswerable, the unbelievable, and it allows us to put in perspective that old notion that tragedy plus time equals humor. Not always. You know, not always. But in a situation where tragedy plus time can equal humor, it's important to laugh. In fact, let me give the best analysis of that. It's from Mark Twain when he said, never enter a funeral laughing, but never leave a funeral without telling a joke about that. And I think you're spot on. Humor isn't always a cure, but it's an anesthesia that helps us deal with that problem and perhaps get over it or offer a different perspective on it.
And it's why sometimes when we look into the history or hear about the life of comedians, people that are really funny, that often their lives were not funny. They were tragic in many cases.
Yeah, really, Pagliacci, you know, the famous opera is part of that. But I think there's an analogy here. For years and years, and now they have a different process. People went into psychology or psychiatry to cure themselves. Teachers who became teachers because they never had good teachers. That's always a phenomenon. But I do think in my study of lots of comics, there is a dark side, and the humor set them free. And certainly a case in point would be Robin Williams. Manic depressive, and his life vacillated back and forth between drugs and alcohol. And by the way, I had the great privilege of seeing him three times, once straight, once stoned, and once drunk. And he was brilliant every time. But the dark side hit him all the time. And, you know, that one dark moment led to that his unfortunate demise. But I do think comics very often use humor the way, you know, doctors self-medicate and hoping to make life better. I agree with you.
One of the things about humor that's so interesting, I was thinking about this in the context of your book, The Importance of Being Funny, is that there's something about humor that is very primal. We talk about, you know, what it is that makes babies laugh. And yet, yeah, as primal as it is, as people grow older, everybody's idea of what's funny is different.
Yeah, my study of humor, and I tried to write this book in a humorous fashion about humor, non-droll fashion about humor, is there's no algorithm to what's funny, and you never can figure out what's funny, and humor changes. It is cultural. It is tied to language. It is tied to time, place. It is tied to your immediate colleagues, et cetera, et cetera. So humor becomes sometimes very, very parochial, and the humor that transcends sometimes is what I call ethnic humor. Now, I want to be careful here. Ethnic humor has a very, very bad reputation in some circles. You know, you can't tell this, you can't tell that. I'm not talking about the vicious ethnic humor. I'm talking about the kind of ethnic humor that transcends the particular ethnicity you're talking about and is really a little myth about every ethnic group. And the example for me is always mother jokes. I think a mother joke about a Greek, Italian, or a Jewish mother is a joke about all mothers or most mothers, et cetera, et cetera. And I love those. That shows our commonality. But I think there's a real danger in jokes. That's why children tell you these silly scatological jokes, and they're not very funny, and you wonder, where does that come from? That's where they are, and you have to recognize that.
There's also a contextual nature of jokes that are important. Yeah. We talk about humor in terms of comedians or movies or television and what holds up, things that might have been funny. How many times have you seen a movie that was funny 20 years ago and you look at it now and what was funny about that?
Yeah, what's funny about that? It doesn't have legs, as they say. Well, I think I try to, again, there's no algorithm, but I try to lay out some steps here. I think humor depends, first of all, on the teller, the jokester. Does the jokester have skills? You know this, whether you're telling a joke at your family table or a dinner party or behind a microphone, you've got to have some talent in it. You've got to deliver, right? So that's part of it. That's why Grandpa, who never tells a joke, says, I heard this really funny one, and he blows it because he doesn't know how to tell it along the way. Secondly, it's the tale itself. You know, is there rhyme? Is there rhythm to it? Is it any good? So on and so forth. And of course, is it appropriate? You know, do you ever tell your mother really naughty sex jokes? I hope not. I don't think so. And so we have to worry about that. And then it's the toll. That is, who are you telling it to? Connected to the tale. Who are you telling this joke to? My wonderful grandson now wants to be a comic because of my research the last couple of years, and I've talked to him about jokes and so on and so forth. But he wants to be a stand-up comic, so we've been exchanging jokes. And, you know, I would tell little jokes like, hey, what did the grape say when the rhinoceros stepped on it? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, not much. He just let out a little whine. Boom, 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 boom. Totally appropriate joke for a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old, right? But then he's coming back and telling me naughty jokes. I'd say, no, you can't tell Grandpa those. You can tell your friends those. You just can't tell Grandpa those. Jokes are contextual. Who's your audience? Who's your audience? Who's your audience? And then finally, timing. And you've alluded to this already. Both the timing of the delivery, you know, do you have good shtick? But most of all, the timing of the joke. And that is, are there 911 jokes? Very few. I don't tell AIDS jokes ever. I just came back from Africa and Rwanda. I would never tell a Rwanda genocide joke, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think time blurt gives us permission to say anything. However, saying that, certainly Mel Brooks has made a career out of, right, the producers in World War II and making fun of Adolf Hitler, et cetera, et cetera. But that's big-time satire, and that's a little different from our tragedies that just down the block and just last week.
Talk a little bit about the difference between jokes and satire, between humor and satire.
Yeah, that's a very perceptive question. I think there is a difference. I make a distinction in the book between show business people, the Milton Berles, the Henny Youngmans of the world, the Bob Hopes of the world, who had people writing jokes to them, and they stood up with a tuxedo in a nightclub and, you know, and told jokes. I mean, I loved Henny Youngman. I loved Henny Youngman. He says, secret to happy marriage, simple, simple, dinner and dancing 2 nights a week. I go on Tuesday, she goes on Thursday, you know, that beautiful kind of stuff. And then something that happened along the way is a guy called Mort Saul. And I think Mort Saul transmogrified comedy from just telling, you know, the minister, the rabbi, and the priest to walk into a bar, boom jokes, and or the dumb blonde said a joke no man would tell again, to social commentary, and to walking out on stage dressed as an affluent professor, you know, in the costume of the V-neck red sweater and khakis and loafers with the New York Times under his arm and make comments about the day. In some sense, he was putting together Mark Twain and Will Rogers. Mark Twain's perception of reality, you know. Ladies and gentlemen, let's talk about Congress, et cetera, et cetera. And Twain would say something really nasty. And, of course, Mark Twain had said, I don't write comedy, I just read the papers. So he brought that together to the stage, and as Time magazine said, Mort Saul is the new comedian. He's funny without being funny. And that transmogrified into, of course, Saturday Night Live, this wonderful thing that happened. But the more serious satire, I think, is seen in Jon Stewart and Bill Maher, who have changed the face of satire in America. That is, it's not jokes. It's probing, detailed analysis of the news. It's not fake news. It may be fake commentary, but they're really at it. They're doing exactly what the jesters of the Middle Ages did. They are speaking truth to power.
Talk about Will Rogers, because in many ways, that's where it all begins in terms of this satire that we're talking about,
yeah,
even more than
yeah.
Twain.
Yeah, it does start with him. I'm not sure that, you know, you can name a couple other people in there, but, you know, you have to pick out the notables. And I think Twain was there as a social commentator across the board and get more specific as he went along. But I think Will Rogers, and modern people don't realize, he wrote 17 books, I believe, and had the most listened to radio show on Sunday night and had a column in the New York Times of all places, and was the second most popular movie personality in America next to Shirley Temple. You know, he was really followed and loved. And he was also a progressive. You know, he had an agenda. There's no question about that at all. He would be closer to Stephen Courbet than he would, you know, Stephen Courbet in his present form versus Stephen Courbet when he was doing that other show. And he really tried to use humor, as he said. I don't write them. I just comment on it. Now, interestingly enough, Lewis Black recently said, In a set that he did in Chicago, he says, tongue-in-cheek, of course, you know, I think I'm giving up comedy. It's not fun to be a comic anymore. I don't have to sit around all day and come up with whimsical things. I just have to read the headlines and say the word Trump, and I get a laugh. But I do think that satire in America is much different, and I think it's progressed to, again, these people are out on the street corners, you know, the town criers, saying, beware, beware. In fact, I think the modern satirist is closer to what Nietzsche meant. And once said, we have art in order not to die of the truth. And I think we have satire in order to not to die of the truth. And our present practitioners do it fairly well.
Where does impersonation and impressions fit into this mix?
Wow. I've never had that question. You're going to get an A+ on this quiz. I think impersonation is more clownish. You're making fun of a personality.
My first memories of impressions as comedy is Vaughn Meader.
Yeah, yeah. But who was he making fun of? Kennedy. And from day one on Saturday Night Live 43 years ago, Chevy Chase was making fun of Jerry Ford tripping. And then Dan Aykroyd was making fun of Jimmy Carter. And they've had every president has been satired by, you know, been put up to satire by or imitated by one of the comics there. I think impressionists, and certainly I'm forgetting, not sure. I can't remember his name right now. The guy who was
Rich Little.
Richie Little. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. Richie Little, exactly. He was marvelous. He was wonderful. And again, I think that's comedy because they're telling jokes along the way. It's blending clownishness, changing one's face, changing one's persona, and delivery together. And I think it still ends up in equals joke or fun. And I think they too are belittling or taking pot shots at that personality and what they represent.
Why is it, in your view, having looked at this, that there are certain cultural similarities to comedians? I mean, we have Jewish comedians, we have Black comedians. What is it about certain cultural and or ethnic groups that lend themselves to this skill?
I don't know if I entirely agree with your question. I do think there are different kinds of comics and different kinds of racial groups or ethnic groups. I think there is a lot of Black comics who are just going up there and doing stand-up, and then there are a lot of Black comics who identify themselves as Black comics and speak to mostly all Black audiences. And I guess you'd have to, you know, I'm not sure that every white comic says I only speak to a white audience. I think humor is larger than ethnicity. I think humor, and maybe Garrison Keillor said it best, I think humor is an attempt to take pot shots at ourselves, that we need to laugh at ourselves. And so Garrison Keillor always loved the Ole and Lena jokes, you know, about the Scandinavians. He says they still had an accent, but they've been here for three generations. But they tried to maintain that ethnicity, and even though while they were in America. He said these weren't simple folks. These were people who were simple in their lifestyles. And his jokes there were an attempt to make fun of their lifestyles that also transcended their lifestyles a little bit. So I'm not sure about the exactness of your question. I think humor, again, Nietzsche, that we create humor in order to not die of truth, I think that's pandemic in human experience. But I think there are some groups, you know, there's a book, there's a wonderful book out there on Jewish humor right now, and he does a great job on it, Michael Krasny, who says that the Jews are the best humorists because they've suffered so much. I think there's a real argument there. I'm not sure if they're the best, but I think pain and suffering necessitated humor. But I think humor is part of the human experience. I think we need to laugh. Psychologists are telling us now that animals laugh, dogs laugh. I've seen elephants laugh, porpoises laugh. And I think so that's part of the need of us as a species.
It's interesting when you talk about suffering so much, because the flip side of that is that there isn't a lot of humor in comfort, in people that are too comfortable.
Yeah. There are not a lot of rich jokes. Oh, my goodness. I couldn't make up my mind between the Mercedes 778 and the Bentley 444. Ha, 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 ha. You know, very funny. No, I think humor is always counterpointal. You're showing the other point, right? You're always doing it. For example, comedy no longer is a group of comics going out there and doing the Henny Youngman shtick, or 1 hour of, you know, Bob Hope went from joke to joke to joke to joke to joke, whether there was a connection or not. Comedy is now Jerry Seinfeld, Louis C.K., and that the whole experience, it's observational. So when Jerry Seinfeld, one of my favorite Jerry Seinfeld jokes is, you know, I didn't realize my voice had a tone, pause, until I got married. You know, is that an ethnic joke? That's a joke about the human experience, right? What marital situation hasn't heard some version of that? It could go either way. The wife could say that as well, right? Et cetera, et cetera.
It's interesting that you could almost tell. I mean, in the history of humor, somebody could do the story of American history through humor, through comedians, through jokes.
Yeah, I think so. And maybe Joan Rivers captured it best when she said, if you could laugh at it, you could live with it, right? And I think we need humor as an escape valve. I think you can see, it's like reading editorials of papers. One of the chapters I was going to do and didn't do because I realized there's a whole other book and there's a lot out there is political cartoons. Mm-hmm. And if you go back through the history, you know, we made fun of Jefferson, the great icon, was made fun of. Adams, the great icon, was made fun of. Not so much Washington, because we didn't know how to do it yet. Lincoln was just salacious stuff in the cartoons. I mean, depicted as a gorilla. I mean, libelous stuff by today's standards. We've used humor as a way to deal with politics, because politics is fundamental to the human situation, and we always have comments about it. Now, you can't always yell at the king, but if you make the king laugh, perhaps you can make your point. And that's what gestures did. And gestures, by the way, were pandemic in the world. It wasn't just King Edward VIII in England who had his favorite jester. Gestures were part of the Cheyenne tradition, part of the Indian tradition, part of the Chinese tradition, part of the European tradition, part of the African tradition, that there was someone designated who had extra potential or powers, okay, plenary powers, and could say truth to power. But they had to be in costume, you know. They had to be playing the role. It's almost what Mel Brooks says. For the jester, jokes were a defense against reality, right? Right. And so they told jokes as a defense against reality, also as a question mark. You want to think that through again, Your Highness? Or do you really want to do this, Your Highness, et cetera, et cetera? This need to laugh. And if we could laugh with it, maybe we could live with it. And maybe along the way, if it isn't perfect, we can amend it a bit.
There's also this interesting nexus in terms of the evolution of humor between humor and language and the way language is used.
Yeah, Yeah. And if you mean accents, that applies, and the nuance of language. I get a little lost on linguistic jokes, but I do understand. I think, help me if I'm going the wrong way here, I think jokes that play on ethnic accents are really, really central to humor. Because I'm Italian and Jewish, I could do a little bit of this. I always had guilt coming and going, by the way. You know, I always tell my universal mother's joke is, fill in the blank. You could fill in the blank on these, but it comes out better if it has a little bit of a Yiddish accent or Italian accent. For example, how many Jewish mothers it take to screw in a light bulb? And the answer is, that's all right. I'll just sit here in the dark. Don't worry about me, right? Or the Italian joke is, what's the difference between an Italian mother and a pit bulldog? And the answer is, sooner or later, the bulldog lets go. Myron Cohen, he stood up on stage and told a Jewish accent, then told a joke with an Italian accent, then he told a joke with a Brooklyn accent, but they were all about human beings in the same situations, but they were funnier because of the language, and I think that, or the accentuation, and I think that's part of it. It's delivery, delivery, delivery.
What about expectation and preconception in terms of humor? In other words, would Henny Youngman be funny today, now that there's more of a narrative to jokes today?
That's a great question. Again, you're stumping me here. I don't think so. I think he'd be an acquired taste. If he just was the new comic up there, he'd struggle with it. Would Don Rickles, would there be a Don Rickles today? No, I don't think so. I mean, he made a career out of being offensive. Foster Brooks, are you old enough to remember Foster Brooks?
Yes.
You know, he came on drunk and just told, he was just drunk. That would not be acceptable. And to get to even closer to home, would Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin, would the character that Lewis was playing, would that be politically correct today?
No.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
No, because he wasn't just jejun. There seemed to be something off about the young man, right? About the character. Would Tommy Smothers be as funny today? That he seems a little too simple, right? And so would the politically correct world say, oh no, now you're making fun of not so smart people. Be careful. No, I think comedy evolves, and what's really funny, it changes. However, there are some things that are constant, and that is political satire. The night Lincoln was shot, in his standard black Brooks Brothers jacket that his wife bought for him, in the tail part, he had four different comedy writers that was cut out of the paper. Tried to read them every day as a moment of freedom from the burdens of the office. They still stand up when you read some of these people. I mean, some of the Greek satirists stand up. You have to know a little history, but they stand up. They're still witty in place. But I don't think, you know, the Seinfelds of the world are going to last forever. You know, in 30 years, will Seinfeld be funny? Will he be as dated as the Marx Brothers? Well, are the Marx Brothers dated? Yeah, it's a different kind of comedy, but you know what I mean. And so I think that is Bob Hope, who was the king of comedy when I was growing up. Absolutely. Forget about him now. He wouldn't have a chance in the comedy world.
Finally, when you look at somebody that has no sense of humor and that doesn't tell jokes and doesn't laugh, what does that tell you?
Well, I think it proves my point that we need humor. We deal with reality with humor. We fight reality with humor. It's a defense against reality. It's a way to hold off the fears of the world, and it's a bonding principle. When I tell you a joke, I'm just reaching out to you and say, are you like me? Do you like this? If we both like this, maybe we have a basis for friendship. You know, I'm giving you a gift right here. And I think the saddest thing you could say of someone, she never told a joke. Maybe not the saddest. She never got a joke. She never laughed. And I think those are people that we don't despise, but actually feel sorry for.
Al Jeanie, The Importance of Being Funny. Why we need more jokes in our lives? Al, I thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
You are very kind and very good questions, and I'm not sure I lived up to your questions, but thank you very much.
You did great. Thank you, Al. I appreciate it. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week. for another Radio Who What Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.